So last week I talked about assumptions, and I said I would continue the talk this week. And assumptions, belief systems, what people take on faith, what you can know as being really authoritatively true. And this is an important issue, I think, for many people involved in spiritual or religious practice and paths, because there's often a creed or belief system that's fundamental to being engaged or to believing it or being involved. And how does that work in Buddhism? Is there a creed in Buddhism? Is there faith? Is there something you have to assume on basic assumptions in Buddhism or basic articles of faith that you're supposed to buy into? And I believe that Buddhism has a little different approach to this issue of beliefs and philosophy and articles of faith than some other religious traditions. And so I think it's interesting. It's different. It's interesting to see that difference and notice what's unique. And for the most part, I think Buddhism, especially in the teachings of the Buddha, tends to be very nuanced or very sophisticated or very critical of the human tendency to believe things. So much so that when the word for ditti, the word for belief or view, the word is ditti, is used without a qualifier in front of it, that the word ditti means wrong view. To have a view, to have a, just take any kind of automatically saying it's wrong or something's off about it. And it's only right if it said sammaditti, right view. And so what is right view? You know, and who are these Buddhists to claim they have the right view? You know, how are they going to manage that? And there's a very beautiful text or teachings by the Buddha. Some scholars feel it's among the oldest teachings of Buddhism or the Buddha. Kind of, and in the Sutta Nipata, and it says this: those who stick to their own views and argue that this alone is true either bring blame upon themselves or obtain praise. Obtaining praise is a trifling thing and not enough to bring tranquility. Realizing this, one should not dispute, but rather see the peaceful state wherein there is no dispute. Those who are upright and who have investigated the various teachings rely neither on others nor on views. Not seeing one doctrine as better than another, they have gone beyond disputes. Having understood, those who are upright do not rely on imagination, views, or intellectual knowledge. Knowing the many types of opinions, they are even-minded toward them all, saying, others may take them up if they desire. The wise have nothing to do with doctrines based on what has been thought out, seen, or heard from others. They have set down their burden and are free, neither attached nor craving for anything. So what does that do to most philosophies and religious points of view? It kind of takes the rug from underneath a lot of things. And in fact, it takes the rug so far away, it says, a Kirat claim is that someone who wants to become peaceful, and that's one of the goals in early Buddhism, is to become someone who's at peace with the world, has attained a peaceful state. You wouldn't be involved in disputes about philosophy and views and religious doctrines and what's right and wrong. But rather would see the peaceful state wherein there is no dispute. So is there some point of view, is there some way of being in the world? In that state, the person would not be inclined to being disputing with anybody else, being arguing with people or feeling threatened with other points of view, or feeling you need to impose your point of view on someone else. In the last days of the Buddha's life, the Buddha, to my mind, made a remarkable statement where he was going to summarize what he had discovered. Here he was, at least nowadays, very famous religious teacher. And what he has to teach as a religious teacher interests people, interests us still to this day. And so he was going to summarize what it is he discovered, what's unique about his spiritual discoveries, spiritual teachings. And he said, if I can find it, I'll summarize it then. He said that, here. What I have discovered and proclaimed should be thoroughly learnt by you, practiced, developed, and cultivated, so that this holy life may endure for a long time, that it may be for the benefit and happiness of many people, and out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of the gods and humans. And what are these matters that I discovered and proclaimed? They are the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four roads to power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the Noble Eightfold Path. So that's a long list of things, so it's kind of maybe dizzying to hear all that. But these are very famous lists called the 37 Wings of Awakening. And what's unique about this is when he claims, this is what I discovered and what I proclaimed, in summary, he's not claiming a belief, a metaphysical claim. This is true. This is a true nature of reality. This is true nature of the self. This is true nature of God. It's not a belief system. He's not saying, this is what I, you know, this is the true view. What he's pointing to, saying, what I discovered, what was unique to me and what I've been proclaiming all these years as a teacher, are particular practices and particular states of mind or qualities of mind that arise when you do these practices. So the four foundations of mindfulness is the practice of mindfulness that we do here. And the others are either practices or qualities that get developed as you practice. So so it's practices and inner qualities, inner states, that what the Buddha points at. Some people nowadays like to distinguish between spirituality and religion. And a lot of people like to say, well, I'm spiritual, but not religious. And what seems to hold, what they seem to be saying is they're not so much interested also in the belief systems as they are the inner cultivation of certain states of compassion, of peace, of love, of generosity. It's not about beliefs, it's about who you become, how you are in the world. And so maybe the Buddha is saying something similar there. So the Buddha wasn't pointing towards a belief or a creed. He's talking about a practice you engage in. And this in cultivation engagement. So in the quote, it says, he tells people you should learn these things. So that involves some learning of something. But the main thing he says, you should practice, develop, and cultivate these things. So it's an activity that we engage in, not a belief system we study and try to master. And we cultivate ourselves in some way. We change ourselves. However, in focusing on this, the Buddha, in his teachings, the Buddha also spent a fair amount of time addressing this issue of beliefs head-on and views. And sometimes he was very challenging to other teachers and spiritual people of his times, challenging them for how could you believe what you believe? What's the basis for that belief system? And, maybe he was a little bit kind of a rebellious kind of guy or contentious kind of guy how we want to think about the Buddha, but he would go around and he would encounter these different people and he would challenge them. How could you know that? They'd challenge him and he'd respond back. So I wanted to read one of these accounts. And here's a man that came to the Buddha. And he was a little bit wanting to challenge the Buddha. And so this is what he asked the Buddha. He said, so this Brahmin, he was a Brahmin student, Kapathika, came to the Buddha and said, Master Gotama. Gotama was the kind of family name of the Buddha. Master Gotama, in regard to the ancient Brahmanic hymns that have come down through oral transmission and in the scriptural collections, the Brahmins come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. What does the Master Gotama say about this? So many religious traditions have books and scriptures and say, this is a true scripture. That's kind of one of the definitions of fundamentalism, when you really believe everything's literally true in your particular scripture. And there's Buddhist fundamentalists and Hindu fundamentalists, and there's Christian, and you know, every religion has their fundamentalists who believe this only, this is true. And so what does Buddha say about this, he asks. And the Buddha replies, how then, among the Brahmins, is there even a single Brahmin nowadays, in that time, who says the following, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. So a lot of Brahmins are saying this is true. And the Buddha is now asking, does anybody know this to be true for themselves? Have they seen this to be true for themselves? And the Brahmin student says, oh no. No, nobody nowadays actually has seen this and knows this for themselves. And then the Buddha asks, well then, among the Brahmins, is there even a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher back to the seventh generation of teachers who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong? And the Brahmin student says, no. No one actually says, I've seen this and know this for myself. How then? Well then, student, the ancient Brahmin seers, the creators of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, whose ancient hymns that were formerly chanted, uttered, and compiled, the Brahmins nowadays would still chant and repeat, repeating what was spoken and recited, and reciting what was recited. Did even these ancient Brahmin seers say, we know this, we see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong? Brahmin student says, no. Maybe you can imagine maybe how Brahmin student's feeling at this point. So, the Buddha continued, it seems that among the Brahmins there is not even a single Brahmin who says, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And among them, then he goes over these different categories. He repeats all that. And then he says, so, here. So the Buddha says, so, suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So too, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. What do you think? That being so, does not the faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? Follow that? Boy, I mean, this is a guy who said you shouldn't dispute anything. You know, but he's, you know, some guy came and asked him, so he's telling him, you know, challenging him. And so then the Brahmin student says, the Brahmins honor this not only out of faith, they honor it as oral tradition. They don't have faith that this is true, but they honor it because it's the tradition for many generations. Then the Buddha says, first you took your stand on faith. Now you speak of oral tradition. There are five things that may turn out in two different ways here and now. So five things might turn out different than how you think they might be. What five? Faith, approval, oral tradition, reasoned argument, and reflective acceptance of a view. These five things may turn out in two different ways. Now, something may be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be empty, hollow, and false. And something else may not be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be factual, true, and unmistaken. And he goes through the others. Same thing can be true there. They can be either true or not true. Whether you believe in them or not believe in them, it doesn't establish them as being true. Belief in itself doesn't establish something as being true. Under these conditions, it is not proper for a wise person who preserves truth to come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And the student asks, how does one preserve the truth? We asked the Buddha about the preservation of truth. So that's a reasonable question. He's really interested in knowing what's true. And how do you preserve the truth? How do you say what's true? How do you make a true statement? If things based on faith, on approval, on tradition, can't be taken as being fundamentally true, how do you know what is true? How can you make a true statement? And the Buddha, this is very interesting, what the Buddha says now in reply. If a person has faith, so the Buddha's not criticizing faith in and of itself, but he says, if a person has faith, he or she preserves truth by saying, my faith is thus. But he does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. In this way, there's the preservation of truth. In this way, he or she preserves the truth. If a person approves of something, if he receives an oral tradition, if he or she reaches a conclusion based on reasoned argument, if he or she gains a reflective acceptance of a view, he or she preserves truth by saying, my reflective acceptance of a view is thus. The oral tradition is thus. I approve of this as such a way. So he doesn't say this is true. He said, I approve of this. I think this is a good idea. It feels right to me. But he doesn't say this is true. By saying that, the person preserves the truth. So then the Brahmin goes further. Is this interesting you? Yes. Reading all this? Sometimes I don't know when I'm reading whether I have people's attention. Okay. And all of you, already, us. In this way, the Brahmin student says, in this way, there is the preservation of truth. In that way, one preserves the truth. But in what way, Master Gautama, is there the discovery of truth? In what way does one discover truth? So now the Buddha has explained how you make a true statement. And now the Brahmin wants to go further than just knowing how to make a true statement. He wants to say, how do I know what's really true? How do I discover the truth? And the Buddha has a reply. He says, a householder or householder's son or daughter goes to a teacher, to a monk or nun, and investigates that monastic in regard to three kinds of states. So you go to a teacher and you check out the teacher. That's the first thing you should do. So it doesn't say, go off in the forest by yourself and discover the truth by yourself. There is some feeling in Buddhism that it's really helpful to go find other wise people. And you can't really be sure whether they're wise first, but you they put out their shingle and say, Insight Meditation Center. And so you kind of think, well, I'll go there rather than going, into Safeway or something. And probably a little better, my chances of finding someone who's wise is a little bit better than maybe, who knows. So you go find a teacher, and you investigate that teacher in regard to three states. In regard to states based on greed, in regard to states based on hate, in regard to states based on delusion. Are there in this venerable one any states based on greed such that, with his mind obsessed by those states, while not knowing, he might say, I know, or while not seeing, he might say, I see, or he might urge others to act in a way that would lead him to their harm and suffering for a long time? So you check out the teacher and say, is that person going to be influenced by greed or by hate or by delusion? Are what they're going to say going to be somehow, if you find the person has filled with greed or hate, well, maybe their teachings will be tainted by that. Or maybe their involvement with you will be tainted by their greed. It might actually lead you to states of harm. It might be harmful for you. And we have lots of examples of spiritual teachers who have harmed their students because of their greed or their hate or whatever. So it's a reasonable thing to ask. And so then, so are there in this venerable teacher any states based on greed or hate? So that while not knowing that he says, I know, that he claims something he doesn't know or she doesn't know, influenced by greed or hate. As he investigates, and you're also supposed to check out the bodily behavior and the verbal behavior of this teacher. So you're supposed to see, are the inner states of greed or hate, and then you're supposed to check, is the speech and the behavior of that teacher conform, also influenced by hate or delusion or greed. Check out. So the call on the Buddhist part is you're supposed to check out the teacher, investigate the teacher, find out what's going on. And a different sutra, it says you should hang out for a long time because you don't really know the state of a teacher until you hang out for a long time with that person. Check it out. So, of course, now this is making me very uncomfortable as I read this. You can imagine. But that's what it says. When he was investigating, when he or she was investigating that teacher and has seen that he or she is purified from states based on greed, the student next investigates the teacher in regard to states based on hate. That's basically the same. So then based on delusion. So you really investigate these things, body, speech, and mind. When the student has thoroughly investigated the teacher, then the student places faith in the teacher. So there is a role for faith in Buddhism. But it's not, on the blind faith, there has to be some checking out of the system, of the situation, some faith or some confidence or some trust in the teacher. And I think all of you, to some degree, have some confidence and trust and faith. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting here. You wouldn't have come today to listen to me. You would have left early or something, or left in the middle or something. Or maybe you're just very polite. But some modicum of faith. Our society is built on that kind of faith. If you take a university extension class at Stanford or somewhere, you have some faith that Stanford has chosen a worthwhile teacher to be your instructor. And then before the class starts, the instructions are to go out and buy this textbook for $150. And, you realize that's kind of a lot, but you have some faith this teacher knows what he or she is doing because, And you might find out your faith was misplaced, but hopefully not. And, unless you have some faith, you wouldn't be able to operate and get along with things. So you have to have, some initial faith in order to make any efforts at all. So, but you don't, in terms of a spiritual teacher, you place faith in the teacher once you've checked them out. But faith is an important quality. So the student places faith in the teacher. Filled with faith, the student visits him or her and pays respect. That's interesting. They pay respect first. So an act of respect. That's kind of doesn't... Normally in English culture, American culture, we don't think of offering a lot of respect. And at least certainly not in the way that they do in India. I know we've had a few Indian people from India come and sit with us. And they feel very uncomfortable. They see me as kind of the teacher, and they see all of you and the way you relate to me. This is not how it's supposed to be done. They interrupt me in the middle of the, you guys interrupt me in the middle of the talk, or some people sit here and they point their feet towards me and they call me Gil, and I like it that way. I don't want you to, do it differently. But it's a very different sense of respect. But they have some kind of respect is necessary. Not for the sake of the teacher, but I think the suggestion is certain level of respect is necessary so that you're willing to take in the teachings, you're willing to hear and listen. Some kind of respect. Then, having offered some respect, the student gives ear, listens, and thus hears the Dharma. And then you heard the Dharma, listen to this, the person memorizes the teaching. Memorizes the Dharma. Now, this is was composed, spoken at a time when people didn't have books. It was a oral culture, and if you wanted to engage and hold and reflect on the teachings, you had to memorize it. It's a very powerful and effective thing to do, to memorize the teachings. And for the people in the concentration class on Wednesdays, there are some more of the Metta Sutta on the table out by the Dana Basket. You're supposed to memorize this. And those of you not in the class, you might want to memorize it also. It's a really good thing, a very helpful part of Dharma practice, to do a little bit of memorization. Just do it to your ability, at least. So memorizes, maybe in modern days, you know, you buy the teacher's book. And then, having memorized it, one examines the meaning of the teachings. I mean, you're supposed to engage in the teachings. Think about them, reflect on them, talk to other people, have discussion groups, and really, you know, really don't just take it on faith or blindly, but really engage yourself in an intelligent way with what you've read or what you've heard or what you've memorized, and reflect on it, think about it. Once you've examined it, then the person obtains reflective acceptance. Reflective acceptance, I understand to mean you kind of take it on faith that these teachings might be useful or valid. So you don't take it automatically as being true, but after thinking about it, you say, oh, this makes some sense to me. I think I'll accept this provisionally. When he has gained reflective acceptance, provisional acceptance of those teachings, zeal springs up. The word is chanda, for those of you who were here yesterday. Enthusiasm for the practice, desire to act, desire to put it into practice arises. And without some desire to put the teachings into practice, there is no path. So after reflective acceptance, then zeal or enthusiasm for putting into practice arises. Let's do this. Let's try it out. When zeal has sprung up, the student applies his or her will. Applying his or her his will, he scrutinizes. I think that scrutinizes is not a good translation. I think it means investigates. One applies investigation to one's practice and to the teachings and to what one was doing. Having applied investigation, one strives. One applies oneself really thoroughly. By striving, the person realizes with the body, with one's own body, the ultimate truth, and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. So there's a whole sequence here. You know, you don't have to follow necessarily the sequence this way, but I think it's a quite wise and beautiful kind of idea of how a person engages, starting off as a raw beginner, to becoming an adept, to becoming penetrated the truth and realize the truth for themselves. A whole sequence of how to find your way. And reading this, it seems to me like a very wise way, a very safe way. It doesn't require believing something on blind faith. This is true. You take something as being provisionally true. At first you say, I have faith that this is true. And that's a true statement. You don't know whether it's true yet. But then you put it into practice. You practice, and through the practice, at some point you penetrate the truth with your own body, with your own eyes and your own mind, and you can have the experience yourself. In this way, there is the discovery of truth. In that way, one discovers the truth. Now, what is the truth in this Buddhist tradition? Is it then that you understand the true nature of reality, the true nature of the self, the true nature of the cosmos, true nature of God? My understanding of what the Buddha had to teach. Excuse me. Again, what he's pointing to as being the ultimate truth is not a truth like a philosophical belief, but the truth of a possibility of being released from our suffering, to being released from our clinging, what we hold on to, what we hold fast to, what we resist, the core freedom, the core truth of the Buddhist tradition is the sure release of the heart which is totally unbound and unrestricted, that is not limited by the shackles of fear, of hate, of greed, of clinging to identity, needing to be someone for somebody. The truth is an experience of release, the heart's release. It's not the truth that now I know this to be true, once and for all, as being, you know. What you know for sure is, I know there's been release. It isn't that you know a philosophy. And that is a little bit disorienting for some people who feel that you need to have a particular philosophy, a particular view about the nature of life, the meaning of life, the purpose of life, in order to feel secure in life, to be happy and peaceful. And the Buddha is suggesting that there's another path to peace, and that is not through understanding the nature of reality, but rather it's through releasing the holding and clinging inside of us. So I'll end with this quote by Thomas Merton. He visited Sri Lanka, and he wrote this in his journal. The path dips down to the Buddhist temple, a wide, quiet hollow surrounded with trees, a low outcrop of rock with a cave cut into it, and beside the cave a big seated Buddha on the left, a reclining Buddha on the right. I am able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing. The peace not of emotional resignation, but of emptiness, that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence, can be frightening. I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock, shape and landscape, figure, rock, and tree. So may each of you discover the truth of the Buddha and the possibility of being at peace without any refutation. Thank you.